Inside Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, the podcast from UVB Online on the Tour de France. For 3 weeks, we accompany team manager Ralf Denk and the biggest and most successful German cycling team through the Tour de France. Do you have questions for Ralf Denk? Send them to tobias.rufi@bmedia.de. And now enjoy the new episode.
Dramatic, tough, and spectacular. The myth of Alpe d'Huez Part 1 lived up to its promise. A large breakaway group pulled away before the legendary 21 hairpin bends and even gained a lead of 4.5 minutes at one point. But Tadej Pogacar takes over right at the foot of the mountain, picks them off one by one, and crowns himself the winner. In the battle for second place, Remco Evenepoel extends his lead a little. As always, we switch over to our man on the ground. He is sitting up in Alpe d'Huez. Hello, Ralf. Hello and greeting from Alpe d'Huez to Rosenheim. Yes, Ralf, we are analyzing everything as always and have to start relatively early this time because a large group formed right away, which, if you look at it in the end, was actually not far from making it. You had a man up front with Cataneo. There seemed to be a lot of unity at times. They were really far away. And I already heard from the riders it was really very, very fast because of that.
How hard did that make it for you right from the start with things really taking off up front? Yes, it was actually a pretty good situation for us. We had Mattia Cataneo up front and he didn't do any pace setting or very little pace setting. It basically went uphill right from the start in gap.
So there was no rolling out. We went straight into the climb and up. Then came the Col de Noyer, the second category mountain today. Then a long valley descent. And then it was already heading towards Alpe d'Huez. The situation was good for us. UAE set the pace at the back. I don't think they were at full strength. Due to illness, the team wasn't at their usual level, but they still managed to at least control the gap. They didn't manage to reduce his lead, but they kept him in check. And when Pogacar attacked at the foot of the final climb, the breakaway's lead was already too small and he really caught everyone. But I don't have the exact ascent time for Pogacar here yet. It didn't look super effortless for him anymore either. So with him and the whole team, you can really see how hard the last 3 weeks actually were here.
Yes, I can at least give you an approximate one. He beat the record set by Pantani in 1995 by about a minute. So he was very, very fast up there. Chapeau. Yes. To follow up on what you just said, Sasha Witzke also observed that, and that brings me to a listener question, that UAE was naturally a bit battered and did not chase with their full team strength. But he said, and you saw it from time to time, you were very present up front, even in the first section. So his question is, why did you do that? Wouldn't it have made more sense to let UAE do everything and not help them at all, perhaps to get Del Toro up there a bit earlier or something similar?
Yes, you have to know that when you are riding relatively far up in the field and perhaps take a turn or two, so if you help out a bit at the front, then the leading team, UAE, will let you stay up there. And we didn't want to take any risks. That means if we're riding in the top 10, 12, including our leader Remco, then we'll most likely avoid the crashes that might happen in the pack because we're sitting so far forward. And that is why you do it for strategic reasons, so that you send one or two riders through the line. But you cannot call it hard pace setting. It is more about presence to secure a position at the front of the pack.
Okay, let's jump right in where the show began. At the foot of Alpe d'Huez, there was still about 3.5 minutes to the front. Right at the climb, Mattia Cataneo drops back to later act as a reference point for Remco Evenepoel, I assume. Or we only saw it in snippets at the back, because then the big Pogacar show began. I'd like to jump in there too. Pogacar goes super early, probably because he knew he had to go right away to catch them up there. Was that good for you, such an early attack, and you just let him go right away and didn't even try to follow? Did I see that correctly?
Yes, we said in the meeting this morning, if Pogacar attacks and it looks super easy, then we'll try to go with Remco. But now I also know his climb time. So 1 minute faster than the phenomenal record by Marco Pantani from the year 1997, I believe. So that record stood for 30 years. But that also means it was really, really fast. And you take a risk if you try to match that pace. And we didn't have to. And that is why we first shifted the work to Decathlon so that they would set the pace. And we were relatively comfortable, first with Chai Hindley, later with Mattia Cattaneo, who came back from the front. We sat in the group and did not have to work. And that was actually a very good situation for us. You just said that Decathlon took over.
You could see Paul Sexus at the front for quite a while, at least when it was cut back. He also still had two teammates who could have dropped back, but that only lasted a short time before the final 5 kilometers at the top, just before the barriers appeared and it got a bit wider. Then Remco Evenepoel said, "Now is my time," and went past. There was a brief moment where it looked like he couldn't get through properly because motorcycles were in the way and it was all a bit too tight. Did you follow that too? Was it really the case that more could have been possible, or how did you see it?
Yes, that was a real shame. I spoke with Remco in the elevator and he was definitely held up after his attack, meaning he actually made 2 attacks. He makes the attack, opens a gap, gets slowed down by the motorcycle with massive crowds on the left and right, so he couldn't get past the motorcycle either.
Then the motorcycle pulls away again.
Remco accelerates again and still managed to maintain or extend the gap to Del Toro and Paul Sexus at the top, but he just said it cost him a massive amount of energy, and that was a shame because otherwise there would have been more seconds between him,
Del Toro and Paul Sexus, who are basically those are the three people who are fighting hard for the podium here, and one of the three mentioned will definitely not be on the podium. That is why the battle is so fierce, and that was a bit of a shame for Remco, but yeah, you cannot do anything about it now in hindsight.
Looking back, wouldn't it have been a bit smarter to attack a little later, since the barriers and spectators were right there holding things back? So he basically has to attack twice. Did he not have that in mind, or why might it be better to attack there? Did he say anything about that?
There is no rule book for when the final kilometers are fenced off, and Remco didn't know that either. Yes, so Remco didn't know that. Are the barriers set up 4 kilometers from the finish, as in this case today, or are they only set up 3 kilometers or just 1 kilometer before? And he followed his gut feeling, and in that moment he told me and confirmed that he felt good, and that is why he attacked then. But unfortunately, there were too many spectators and the lane was too narrow, so he could not get through. It was still enough, though. That means, I assume, you are still leaving this stage with a very good feeling.
There are a few more seconds again to the two pursuers, Del Toro and Sexus. They didn't gain much on each other. Should Sexus have done more, or did he do too much at the start and couldn't keep up because of that?
How did you see that? The Decathlon team went all in for Paul Sexus. They were able today, after the start, to have 2 riders in the lead group. They were basically relay stations that dropped back. They still had 1 rider with Paul Sexus for a long time.
So they did everything right. But you could also see that 19-year-old Paul Sexus is a bit tired. He is riding his first 3-week Grand Tour here.
So hats off to where he is currently riding in 4th place as a 19-year-old in his first 3-week Grand Tour. That is a phenomenal performance, and it is completely normal that he is a bit tired now on the 19th stage, perhaps not quite as fresh anymore, but they fought like lions too.
only one person doesn't seem to mind at all. There was a lot of speculation. A, the team is weakened. Maybe there's a virus going around. Tadej Pogacar doesn't care at all. I think he really wanted to add his name to the legendary list of winners at Alpe d'Huez today. And he did that very impressively.
Would you agree with me there? Yes, definitely. Here, up here, many great cyclists have won. There have been underdog victories here too, but winning at Alpe d'Huez, having that on your palmarès when you eventually end your career, that is something truly great. I as team manager or team boss have never won up here as a racer either, but it is something honorable, and you could see how besieged the mountain was by cycling fans, and that was
the cycling event of the year so far here, and that is something very, very prestigious.
I would say this, a German victory at Alpe d'Huez is still missing, so maybe you can tick all those boxes with your team. That might be something for the future.
We make no secret of the fact that we would have loved to have Florian Lipowitz with us today, and we missed him at Eerle. We are in contact with him. He is back home now. He is doing okay, but he is suffering along with us, and we are suffering with him that he cannot experience these cool stages here for which he had specifically prepared in his planning for the final weekend. I feel very sorry for him.
Absolutely, especially since I've heard from many riders at the finish line how incredible it was again today. Unbelievable, crazy, so loud, nothing comparable across all sports, as Shahindi said in the interview earlier. You are on side too. How did you experience it today? I saw there was even a traffic jam this morning because there were so many people down there. We are talking about a good 500,000 people. What is going on there? Do you have some impressions for us?
Well, the mountain has been closed to cars and motorhomes for 2 days now. That means if you want to park your motorhome by the roadside, if you want to spend a few nice days here, you have to arrive 2 days early. Otherwise, it is a state of emergency. Parties, I saw some pictures and videos yesterday. Deep into the night, the cycling fans were partying here. It is all very, very peaceful here.
That is impressive. Well, you can... When you see football fans, as when two teams meet, it usually doesn't end well, or you can't let them near each other without police protection. That is different here in cycling. It is much, much more peaceful, and it is a celebration here. It is unique, and anyone who is a bit of a cycling fan has to have seen this live, because we go to many corners, we ride up many mountains, but Alpe d'Huez is Alpe d'Huez. Alpe d'Huez is Alpe d'Huez, and it will be again tomorrow.
We will get to that in a moment. Perhaps a quick note, or rather a message that reached me. There were definitely fans of the podcast on site, because I received a picture where it said in bold with the Red Bull logo, "Best regards back to Rosenheim." Well, I think there were definitely some people there who follow the podcast regularly, even on that legendary final climb. The greetings are hereby delivered. That is nice to know. I am pleased. Ralf, let us look at tomorrow. Even then, Alpe d'Huez remains Alpe d'Huez. We are riding a big loop tomorrow, but we have, and it will be even tougher, 3 climbs of the highest category before we return to the same finish line. How do you see tomorrow's queen stage, as many call it, and what will it come down to? Yes, first of all, a quick word on the route.
It is at the bottom of Alpe d'Huez start, then it goes straight up the Col de la Grosse Fère. That is a mountain of the highest category, then down into the valley, the Maurienne, then up to the Col du Télégraphe. A short descent from the Col du Télégraphe, then comes the Col du Galibier again with 16, 17 kilometers, then back down over the Col du Lautaret, a long descent through the valley, and then up the back way to Alpe d'Huez.
Going up to Alpe d'Huez from the back is not comparable to the road we rode up today. It is very, very narrow.
And I'm really curious how the organizers will manage that tomorrow, because you've seen a lot of campers and tents and cars along the roadside. There's absolutely no room for that tomorrow. That is that will be difficult when two cars meet, one coming from above, one from below, if no one is currently in them. And the mountain is something special. It is not quite as much elevation gain as the white road we rode up today, because you turn off further up the valley, but it will be a phenomenal farewell to the Tour de France, to the high mountains. And yes, we are looking forward to it. We are also quite optimistic for tomorrow, because Remco showed good form today, and my conversation in the elevator with him earlier, he didn't really make a broken impression on me, and we will see how the race goes. We are in a situation where we are not really attacking first place in the general classification. I think we would be a bit naive to do that. We saw Pogacar's level again today, but we don't need to be the first to go on the offensive now, because we have enough of a gap to third, fourth and fifth place, and we will watch how the race develops over the great Alpine giants. The elevator conversations are encouraging. We are happy about that.
I have some information for you that might be interesting. Tadej Pogacar said at the finish line that he secured the win for Alpe d'Huez today. Tomorrow he will go on full attack together with Del Toro to secure the white jersey and the podium. That's what I gathered.
Does it mean something different for you if Pogacar becomes a super domestique again, or does it change nothing for you? Primarily, Del Toro also has to follow Pogacar first, and one could also see that he was not the freshest today either.
Well, for us, the strategy with Pogacar as a hungry for victory rider, or Pogacar as a super domestique, it won't change anything. We will ride our own race. And I have to pay my team a compliment today. They stayed relatively together for a long time on the final climb. So we will stick to our own tactics, but we are going into tomorrow with more confidence.
The advantage is that you are right there. The start will be at the bottom, basically at the entrance to Alpe d'Huez. As far as I understood it correctly, you are at the top like most teams. Does that also mean a bit more capacity and time for you, right?
No, the whole weekend is a logistical nightmare, you really have to say. We started an hour and a half south today. You could almost see the Mediterranean this morning. The trucks had a meeting point at 8 o'clock this morning down at the foot of the mountain, so they could drive up here, the route that the racers drove up later. So this whole weekend, as nice as it is, the cycling festival, but for us as teams, it is an immense effort. We have the brutal stage tomorrow. We are also traveling to Paris by car tomorrow, and the riders are taking the TGV. So the day tomorrow will be extremely long again, and we will all be a bit relieved once we have reached Paris.
I can imagine. As a fan, you naturally imagine it to be much more pleasant than it is when you are there. But that is what we have you for. Thank you very much, Ralph, for today, and we will of course look at Alpe d'Huez Part 2 together again tomorrow, then with my colleague Tobias Roof. I would therefore like to say goodbye and send my greetings to France one last time.
My pleasure, and greetings back to Rosenheim.
That was the latest edition of Inside Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, the podcast from OVB Online on the Tour de France. You can find the podcast on all common podcatchers and on the websites of OVB Media and IPEN Media. Thanks for listening, and see you in the next episode.